So with that plug for what you do, and I will be happy, I'll be delighted to entertain any comments or questions that you might have. And you don't have to worry about the subject matter. If I can't answer it, I won't. Yes.
Legality, compossible. I don't know what that means.
Compossibility. Compossibility is a fancy word that was coined by an English philosopher named Hillel Steiner. And Robert Nozick uses a similar word in Anarchy, State, and Utopia called copossibility. It's actually a very simple concept. It's a formal requirement of a rights theory, for reasons that I argue in the book are necessary, a formal requirement of a rights theory that all rights be able to be exercised without conflicting with each other, so that they be co-possible, that everybody who's acting within their rights could act within their rights and nobody's actions would conflict with anybody else. So a compossible theory of rights will coordinate human action, because if you actually do what you're supposed to do, your actions aren't going to conflict with anybody else's. That's what it is. Yes?
I'm sorry, what chance do you think that there is that the Ninth Amendment and the Privileges and Immunities Clause will actually be revived?
A lot better than I thought it was when I first started writing about it, which was in 1989 or 1988. A couple things have happened since then. First of all, the Ninth Amendment has been used by the Supreme Court in a meaningful way in the Casey versus Planned Parenthood case. Which was an abortion case, but they actually used the Ninth Amendment. It was a jointly authored opinion by authored by Justice O'Connor, Souter, and Kennedy. In the actual text, they cite the Ninth Amendment as authority for the proposition that liberty is not limited to the liberties that are listed in the Bill of Rights. They use it exactly the way it ought to be used. It ought to be used in other ways too, but they use it perfectly appropriately. That, I think, is a pretty good sign. And I do think, by the way, it resulted from, where did that come from? I don't think it just happened accidentally. It came, I think, as a result of the confirmation of each of these three justices, which followed the confirmation hearings of Robert Bork. Robert Bork was asked what he thought the Ninth Amendment meant. Well, let me back up for a minute. Let me tell you a little story about how I got to be a Ninth Amendment scholar. I was asked by the Federal Society to come and talk to the National Student Symposium. I'd never been invited to any Federal Society talk before, to do event before. I really wanted to accept, but I was asked by a former student of mine, a student of mine from Institute for Humane Studies, not from where I was teaching, who went to Stanford Law School and then asked me to come. He was the head of the. I said, "Look, Brian, you know, I don't do constitutional law. I'm not interested in constitutional law. I am now, but this is what got me started." And the reason I wasn't interested in constitutional law, I lost all interest in constitutional law in law school when I took constitutional law. I had Larry Tribe as a constitutional law professor, but that's not the reason. He was actually a very good constitutional law professor. All I had to do was read Supreme Court opinions in which every good part of the Constitution was explained away or explained into oblivion. And then I thought, what good is this? This is a waste of time. I mean, it doesn't matter what you write down, they're going to find some different way of interpreting it, so it ended up they get the result they want, and so I'm going to worry about something else. And contract law was something I thought was worth worrying about. There actually is law there to worry about. So I said, you know, Brian, I'm not interested in this. He said, oh, come on, you can say something. You can do, you know, only 10 minutes. And I was on a very distinguished panel. Frank Easterbrook was on this panel, who's for those of you who don't know, is a very former professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School, now on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. He was then on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And I wanted to accept, so it was on a panel on, it was a conference was on the First Amendment, it was a panel on freedom of association. And so I was writing this thing on freedom of association, which I didn't know all that much about, but I was defending freedom of association. And I got to the end of this, and I knew I was talking, I had a misconception of the Federal Society. It turns out the Federal Society, as those of you know, is an amalgam, it's a coalition of libertarians and conservatives. I really thought it was all conservatives and not a coalition. And so I thought this was going to be a relatively hostile audience for what I had to say. And so I got to the point where I'm talking about freedom of association. Well, freedom of association isn't mentioned anywhere in the Bill of Rights per se. It's supposed to be part of the First Amendment, but it doesn't say freedom of association in the First Amendment. So I got to the line in my talk where I said, I know what you're thinking, which actually was a crib from Dirty Harry. I know what you're thinking. You know, what gives lifetime appointed judges, federal judges, the power to make up this kind of right? So that was my setup line. Well, when I gave this talk, Frank Easterbrook was sitting next to me on the panel, and there were like 400 or 500 people there at Stanford Law School. And Easterbrook was sitting next to me. We were both sitting at the table at the time we were giving this talk, and I gave this talk, and I got to the point where I know what you're thinking. What gives lifetime appointed federal judges the power to decide what you know, that there's such a right, this unenumerated right? And Easterbrook goes to like this. He pantomimes. He's kind of a demonstrative fellow. He went like this. Like, and the answer is, you know, and so this was in front of 400 people, right? And the answer is, you got good silence. And so I said, well, in the Constitution, it says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And the audience just exploded in applause. I was like flabbergasted. Believe me, I did not expect this reaction. I mean, cheering, yeah, yeah. Whoa, you know. Years later, people come up to me and they say, you know, I was at the Federal Society where you debated Frank Easterbrook on the Ninth Amendment. There was no debate. We weren't even talking about the Ninth Amendment. I mean, he did this, I said that. That was the whole debate. But that was how, anyway, so I had to decide at that point whether I wanted to pursue this as an academic, as a scholarly exercise, because I got lots of things to do with my time and I want to use it productively. This is why this is actually an answer to your question. Was it worth my time? Was it worth scarce time to devote energies to this? If it's such a, I knew what the reputation of the Ninth Amendment was as kind of an oddball provision that nobody talks about. What are you going to argue the Ninth Amendment? The argument of last resort never works. I wasn't going to devote years of my life and my reputation, which at this point was pretty fledgling, to this idea if there wasn't some sense of some prospect of improvement. And here's the calculation I went through at the time. First of all, it was a matter of principle in some sense. First, I had just gotten tenure, so I said, I got tenure, that's got to be good for something. And secondly, I said, they haven't repealed it, and I ought to be, with tenure, I ought to be able to talk about any part of the Constitution that actually hasn't been repealed. So that gets me off the ground. Now, whether it's a good idea or not, here was the calculation I went into. I said, the right is now, at that point, basically making two arguments vociferously. One is an argument in favor of original intent. The other one is an argument in favor of a narrow construction of individual rights. And they're making both of these arguments very forcefully. It's only a matter of time before people on the left, who basically run the intellectual agenda of academia, are going to realize that the Ninth Amendment is a way to confound the right. That they can just say, well, what do you say about this? Because here's original intent, and yet it's a broad thing for individual rights. And I said, when the time comes from the left for the left, to make this move, it would be nice if I were already there with my scholarship, having already written about the Ninth Amendment, then I could be the guy. So that was the tactics, that was the sort of the entrepreneurial thing, calculation that went in. So as a result of this, I began writing an article on the Ninth Amendment, which ultimately was accepted by Cornell. It was also the introduction. I got a book contract to do an anthology on the Ninth Amendment, and then I commissioned a symposium issue of the Chicago Kent Law Review, where I then taught on the Ninth Amendment, where I got to invite and pay all these people, these prominent people, to write about the Ninth Amendment, which everybody, I should tell you, was really anxious to write about at that point. I got a great reception. Almost everybody I asked to write about it said yes. So I had all these projects in the works. Nothing had quite come out yet, but they were all commissioned. People had been written about. They were in process. And then Robert Bork gets nominated to the Supreme Court. And he gets, and it's on C-SPAN, because now we have C-SPAN, so we can watch this stuff. And so it's on C-SPAN. And what happens to Robert Bork? Joe Biden, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I think I personally think Biden acted exemplary in this whole process. I mean, I think a lot of other people should be condemned for the way they dealt with this, but not Biden. I think Biden was a real mensch about this whole thing. Joe Biden gets into a constitutional discussion with Robert Bork, in which he asks him, "Well, what do you say about the Ninth Amendment? How do you read the Ninth Amendment?" And he was coached to do that by a Duke law professor. It wasn't something Biden thought of by himself. But he was coached to do this by a Duke law professor. And so he asked this question. Well, and Bork was completely confounded. I mean, you know, I had predicted the left would use this against the right. I didn't predict the left would use it against the right on C-SPAN in front of a national audience. And what was Bork's response when he was asked about the Ninth Amendment? Well, he fumbled and mumbled a bit. And he said a number of things. For example, he said, well, I don't know what it means, and if someone would tell me what it means, I would be happy to use it, but I just don't know what it means. And then he offered what became a famous metaphor, which has been of great use to me, as you can imagine. He said, it's as though there was you had a copy of the Constitution and there was an ink blot on it, and you couldn't read what was under the ink blot. I don't think judges should make up what's under the ink blot. Well, it was an interesting little metaphor. I think it may have been spontaneous, but it was the wrong answer. It was the wrong answer legally, it was the wrong answer politically, it was the wrong answer philosophically. You don't just take the Constitution and say, it's like there's an ink blot on it, you can't read it. We can read it. You can't read it. We can read it. And that just sparked this big interest. And after that, every Supreme Court nominee was asked about the Ninth Amendment. And O'Connor, I guess, was already on the court. But all of them were. Kennedy was, and Souter was, for sure. And I think Souter might have been the next appointment. I can't remember. No, Kennedy was the next appointment. But whatever, they both were asked about it. And they had to come up with a better answer because they already knew they'd been taught what the wrong answer was by example. So they had to have a better answer. So they actually had to think a little bit more hard about it and talk to some people who knew more about it. And they started saying stuff like, well, yeah, it kind of means something. Well, then they had the opportunity in Casey to use what they had now. Not only is this respectable, but they were forced to answer this question this way because of what had happened to Bork. And they did. And so that's the. Now, as for the Privileges or Immunities Clause, a very interesting thing has happened about that. And for those of you who are not lawyers, the privilege, I left my copy of the Constitution upstairs because I haven't memorized it. Prior to the 14th Amendment, there was no federal jurisdiction to protect, except in rare cases like the Contracts Clause, which is in the body of the Constitution. But generally speaking, there was no federal power to protect individuals from having their rights violated by their own state governments. That was not part of what federalism was understood, based on a famous case called Barron versus Baltimore. Some people argued that it was wrongly decided. I think it might have been probably rightly decided, but whether it was right or not, that was settled law. It was something that the radical Republicans in the Reconstruction period were, actually they were against it before the Civil War and they became against it afterwards. They were bound and determined to reverse Barron versus Baltimore and say, yes, the federal government could protect individuals from having their rights violated by their state governments. And that's what the 14th Amendment was intended to do, and particularly is what the Privileges or Immunities Clause was intended to do, for those of you who didn't know what this was about. An interesting thing has happened. I think there is now a consensus by right-thinking, meaning left-thinking, law professors, that that's what the Privileges or Immunities Clause meant. I don't get an argument about it. Nobody argues about that anymore. I mean, there's a couple historians who kind of qualify it, but by and large, I mean, I've just been at one conference after another or one context after another where eminent, prominent people, I mean, Larry Tribe among other people, argue, yeah, that's probably what it meant. And because good historical work has been done by a progressive scholar whose book I highly recommend to you called No State Shall Abridge. His name is Michael Kent Curtis. He's a professor now at Wake Forest, but he actually wrote this book when he was in practice. He's kind of a country North Carolinian lawyer. I say political progressive, generally, an ardent Clinton supporter and all that. Thinks Ken Starr is the devil incarnate. But he's written this brilliant book called No State Shall Abridge, in which he talks about what the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, Privilege and Immunity Clause, was. I think it's prevailed. I think it won out. Now, I don't know how long it's going to take. I'm not promising you that the court is going to follow this, but that seems to be a prerequisite. The first step to getting judicial change is getting academic change. It's also happening, by the way, in the area of the Second Amendment. It's not quite as far along because there's a lot more politics involved. But there's a pretty overwhelming consensus amongst people who study the Second Amendment, regardless of their political views, that it protects an individual right. I'm not optimistic that this court would find that, but it's a prerequisite for any future court to find it, that there becomes a scholarly consensus on the subject. So the long answer is, summary is, I'm optimistic for that reason.
In your book, you quote John Locke.
You bought a copy of my book.
Right. page 4, where you have from the Second Treatise the quote that the state of nature has a law of nature to govern mankind, and that being all equal and independent, I guess that's the given, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. So that seems to be, that I have two parts. So the first part is, would you say that that is a natural law, that no one ought to harm another?
I think that's a very general. I would say that's an insatisfactory formulation of what natural rights are, and the reason I say that is because harming is too general. We harm each other in many, many ways that I think we have a right to do, and so I would say that's the problem with the million harm principle. It's just too general and not specific enough. So I would say that read literally, I don't agree with that principle. But I don't think that, I think Locke is not speaking literally there. I think he has a more specific view of what harm would be that you find elsewhere.
So you would call that a natural right, not a natural law? That statement that no one ought to harm another?
It could be, truthfully, it could be either. Because there could be an idea that to live the good life, you shouldn't harm other people. And there also could be a natural right against being harmed by other people. So it can be either.
The gist of my question, where you differentiated natural law and natural rights, and here was an example where it seemed to me they were quite close.
There's an overlap. I think an appropriate view of natural law ethics would say you shouldn't violate natural rights. I think that would be one of the things that acting virtuously would mean, don't violate other people's rights. But you would do that so that you can be happy, so that you could live the good life. You would do that for your own sake. You would do that for the sake of your own ethics. You would not do that because that's the way of solving great social problems, I don't think. Where that's why you have natural rights, is to solve the social problem of human interaction. I should also say that quote does illustrate one thing, and that is that people who talk, even in the historically, who talked about natural law and natural rights, sometimes use those terms interchangeably. And you have to look at the context sometimes to see what they're really talking about. So it's not like if you go back in the historic literature, you're going to get a neat distinction between the terms as I'm drawing them. But I think it's useful to have a neat distinction between terms, if we can find one.
I'm going to drag you back into the Ninth Amendment for a moment.
That's fine.
A couple of years after the confirmation hearings, Judge Bork was quoted as saying that he thought that what was intended originally in the Ninth Amendment was to incorporate the rights found in state constitutions. Do you think that is historically accurate, and is it inconsistent with your formulation?
As all things with Judge Bork, and I should say that, and I can talk about this at greater length if you want, I don't have a very high opinion of him as a scholar or a judge. Maybe not so much as a judge, but as a scholar. It's not his idea. There's one article that he used in saying that in Tempting of America, which was written by a guy named Russell Kaplan, whose article, it was published in the Virginia Law Review, one of the few examples of pre-Bork Ninth Amendment scholarship. And I do put it in the first volume of my anthology on the Ninth Amendment, because I think it was a classic article. I think it's wrong. Let's put it this way. It overstates the case. It may very well be that the rights retained by the people do not refer only to natural rights. I don't know that I believe they refer only to natural rights, only that they include natural rights. And the evidence Russell Kaplan offers for the idea that they would include natural... truthfully, I haven't read Kaplan's article in probably 10 years, because it's not in play at the moment, but the evidence that he argues does not prove that they didn't does not exclude the possibility. In other words, there's no evidence that says we don't mean natural rights. None whatsoever. Zero evidence of that. And all the evidence, one way or the other, is circumstantial. And his evidence might show that some people had in mind constitutional rights, but not that other people didn't have in mind natural rights. As I said at the time, there's not unanimity. I had Russell Kaplan's article in mind when I was thinking that there was not unanimity. In fact, I think the overwhelming authority is that these rights include natural rights, including, for example, James Madison. When he introduced the Bill of Rights in Congress, he talked about the pre-existent rights of nature. So it was on their minds. And there's another piece of evidence which I include I can't remember if it's volume one or volume two of the Rights Retained by the People, is a discovered copy of the of another draft of the Bill of Rights that was written by Roger Sherman, who served on the committee to draft the Bill of Rights along with James Madison. And his Second Amendment talks about that people have certain natural rights when they enter in society, and that they retain when they enter into society, and among those are, and it li- so it sp- explicitly links natural rights with retained rights. From a draft of the Bill of Rights that was in the room, it was found amongst Madison's papers. For many years, nobody knew what it was. It was only identified as Roger Sherman's draft in 1989, because prior to that, nobody knew what it was, because Madison had a copy of it, and they had to be identified as Sherman's. But that was a smoking. Up until that point, people could argue. By the way, this shows how willful some of this argument is, because no matter how many smoking guns I produce, somebody has another argument. Well, that doesn't mean that. I have a running battle with this one other constitutional scholar named Thomas McAfee, and I keep producing one definitive piece of evidence, and then he has some convoluted explanation around it. So it shows that there's no evidence that will satisfy him. But I think a piece of paper from the committee that drafted the Bill of Rights that links natural rights, called natural rights retained, is enough to tell you that retained refers to natural rights, perhaps among other things. No. No, that was pretty much a Madisonian initiative. Not entirely, but he had their precursors from it. The Ninth Amendment was entirely a Madisonian invention. He invented that. People have tried to find precursors, but the precursors they find are primarily precursors of the Tenth Amendment. There were some things that might have given him the idea, but it was a Madisonian solution to a Madisonian objection to the Bill of Rights. Can I just say this? Madison, along with other Federalists, had a very specific shouldn't say that. Back up a minute. The Constitution, as you know, was ratified with no Bill of Rights. The Anti-Federalists used that to great political effect in opposing the ratification of the Constitution on the grounds that it lacked a Bill of Rights. Therefore, the Federalists, who are the people who supported the Constitution, had to come up with an argument as to why the Anti-Federalists were wrong about why there had to be a Bill of Rights. And they came up with two arguments. Madison did, among others. But Madison believed them, and he argued them vociferously. One is that a Bill of Rights is unnecessary because it was a government of limited powers, and it was never granted the power to violate rights. Two, a Bill of Rights would be dangerous, because if you enumerate some rights, later on it would lead to the construction that these are the only rights you have. Those are the arguments made as to why you didn't need a Bill of Rights. That argument didn't win. If the Federalists hadn't promised a Bill of Rights, the Constitution would not have been ratified at the critical key juncture. So they promised to have a Bill of Rights later. They just ratify now, we'll give you a Bill of Rights later. Madison, by the way, was one of the few people who really worked hard to keep that promise. The rest of Congress, the first Congress, wasn't interested in the Bill of Rights. Madison kept getting up in front of Congress. He kept saying, well, it's time to take up the Bill of Rights. And all the other congressmen kept saying, no, don't bother us now. You know, we don't even have taxes yet. We got first things first. So they weren't interested in that. But Madison kept coming up, and I begged the indulgence of the House. We need to do this. We know there are people out there who don't trust us, and we need to prove to them they're bona fides. There's some states that haven't come in yet. We've got to prove to them we were honest. And eventually they say, okay, fine. We'll form a committee. You can be the head of it. You go off and do a Bill of Rights. Come back and tell us about it. And so they did that. And he came back, and he came back with this Ninth Amendment. And he said, when he introduced the Ninth Amendment in the first House, when he was explaining his proposal, he said, look, there's one objection to having a Bill of Rights that I've always considered the most persuasive. He didn't say, because that's the objection I made, and that is the idea that there'll be an inference that if you enumerate some rights, the rest of the rights will be, what in his words, surrendered up to the general government. And he says, that I believe I've rectified, as the gentleman might see by looking at the, and then he named the passage, it wasn't called the Ninth Amendment then. And so then he did that. Okay, that was a Madisonian invention. One more little thing about the Ninth Amendment. Something that another smoking gun, which never satisfies the opposition. One smoking gun is this piece of paper. There's another smoking gun, and that is that it was, I didn't discover this, but this was completely ignored except for one person is where I got it from. Madison used the Ninth Amendment in a constitutional argument in Congress, on the floor of Congress, when he gave a speech saying that the First Bank of the United States, the bill that was pending for the First Bank of the United States, was unconstitutional. He used lots of arguments. He gave a brilliant speech, and I reproduced that speech in the second volume of The Rights Retained by the People, which unfortunately I think is out of print. But and in this speech, among other things, he uses the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. And this has been it's not ignored anymore, but it had been completely ignored by all but one scholar who had it mentioned in a footnote, which I read when I was doing my Ninth Amendment work, and it took me several years to follow up on the footnote. It just didn't register with me. Eventually I did, and there it was, the smoking gun. Madison uses the Ninth Amendment, and how does he use it? And he also explains how it relates to the Tenth Amendment, which I think is also interesting. He said, what does the Tenth Amendment say? He says, the Tenth Amendment says that Congress can only act within its enumerated powers. Pretty much what the Tenth Amendment says. And he also, by the way, when he introduced the Tenth Amendment, said that was a mere truism. Didn't need to be put in there, but we're going to put in there because people want to put in there. A lot of states wanted that put in there, by the way. That was not an invention of Madison. He thought that was a truism. The Congress can only act within enumerated power. The Ninth Amendment, he says, argues against a latitudinarian interpretation of those powers. In other words, don't interpret them broadly. Interpret them narrowly. And So it does real constitutional work, according to Madison, the guy who invented it, in the only known instances in which it was used in constitutional argument. And I think the reason for that is because it's the means by which you protect the rights retained by the people, is by construing powers narrowly. That's what he thought. And so it argued against a latitudinarian interpretation of constitutional powers.